welcome to episode 2 of the View from the Bleachers Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Aiello, and today I'm just joined by Josh Cornwall. Sean is actually on assignment in Sochi covering the Winter Olympics, and so we welcome him back hopefully in a couple of weeks. But in the meantime, Josh, it's good to have you.
Thanks, Joe. It's been a good week off. Not really off, I guess I'm still working, but off the air.
Yeah, it feels like forever since we recorded the last episode. I don't know about you, but I was thinking about it a lot all week, excited about this episode, and I think it'll show in the fact that I put together a crap ton of notes for the show today.
You did. 447 words worth.
Well, that's not even counting the notes that I didn't send you for the like it or strike it section, so it came out 518 on my end there.
Fantastic.
Well, let's jump right in. I just want to remind our listeners, in case you haven't already, subscribe to the show on iTunes. Just search for VFTB, that stands for View from the Bleachers, on iTunes, and you can find us. It'll pull us right up there, and you can subscribe to the show. If you could do that, we would appreciate it. And also, if you could remember to rate and review the podcast, that helps us as we climb up the iTunes charts. Hopefully, we'll get noticed a little bit more and get more listeners, and hopefully that'll make the podcast a little bit more fun for everybody. So just remember to go to iTunes, subscribe, listen, and rate there as well. You can also follow us on Twitter. All my tweets are at VFTB. Again, that stands for View from the Bleachers. You can find Josh at JC Stats. That's at JC Stats. And then Sean, if you want to follow him, even though he's not here and doesn't feel like he's dedicated to the show apparently, he is at Powell_Sean, and that's spelled S-E-A-N. So that's at Powell_Sean.
Powell Seen,
that's right. You can also email the show. Any questions or comments to the show, we'd love to have them. And you can email the show at viewfromthebleachers@gmail.com. Well, Josh, let's jump right into it, and let's get back into the news of the week. A lot happened over this course of this week, and so let's try to cover it as quick as possible. And let's start with probably the biggest story of the week, and that was Jeff Samardzija and the Cubs agreeing to a contract, 1 year, $5.3 million. It came down to the wire. I think Cub fans are just happy to have this behind them, and now we'll look forward to what happens with Jeff Samardzija going forward. Tell me your initial thoughts when you saw on the wire that Samardzija agreed to a contract.
Well, I'm kind of glad that we were right last week when we said both Barney and Samardzija would get their one-year deals. This gives the Cubs a chance to either to decide whether he's going to be part of their long-term plans, give him a new contract, I guess, sometime during the season, or immediately after the season, depending on how bad the team is, or move him for something else. Because although the only bad thing about that is he will be a free agent after the season. So I don't know. Is he part of long-term plans or not? And that's what everyone's been asking. That's what everyone wants to know. That's what we talked about last week. It's good to have him back, but at the same time, it doesn't really clear up the long term. It only clears up this year.
Right. I took a look at some of the projections on FanGraphs today for Jeff Samardzija and really the team as a whole. And a lot of them just seem to be middle of the road for Samardzija. A lot of his peripherals just don't seem overall dominant. Really seem a lot more what this contract represents for the 1 year. I'm curious to see what's going to happen with him as well. I tend to think that he is not ace-worthy material. But that he's going to command ace-worthy or at least number two starter material money on the open market. And so it's going to be an interesting next couple of months as we head into July and just see what the team's overall focus is. I tend to think that he will be moved. I don't think it'll be before spring training ends, but I think that you'll see the talks heat up, especially if he's showing good to average, or average to good stuff on the mound. I think that there'll be a demand there. There's always a demand for young starting pitching, and I think the Cubs would love to transition him into younger starting pitching to start to help some of those hitters that are going to be coming up and balance that talent in the system out a little bit. But I was happy to see the deal. You don't ever want to see anybody go to arbitration, and so I was happy to see that. And then with that said, the other name, Darwin Barney, agreed to a deal, 1 year, $2.3 million. This one, I honestly thought that there was a chance that these guys could go to arbitration, even though they finished before Samardzija, just because of how bad Barney was. I thought that the Cubs had every right to go to arbitration and state their case and show that, hey, this guy was brutal last year. But they didn't. They split the difference, and in the end, it ended up with a one-year, $2.3 million deal.
Did he end up above the Mendoza line last year?
Yeah, I think he hit like 230. I don't think he was that bad, but
no, he did not hit 230.
I think he did. I'm gonna check it, and if you can hear the keystrokes on Baseball Reference, I apologize, but let's see. Darwin Barney last year, 208.
208?
208.
Oh, yes. That's brutal. I mean, $2.3 million is not a lot of money for a second baseman. That's going to probably be the starter for at least the first half of the season.
Well, you know, it's funny. I wonder what your feelings are on this. I've made it no secret that I'm not a big Darwin Barney believer, but I'm curious to see what your feelings are. When we look at 2012, he posted a 4.8 WAR. In 2013, he was at -0.5. So it's a high and low. Where do you go with that? I don't think he's a 4.8 WAR player, but at the same time, I don't think he's a negative player either. So do we see something kind of in the middle? Is he a two guy, or where would you say that you could see him this year?
He just doesn't offer anything on the offensive end. I mean, maybe he earns a few walks because he's at least patient somewhat.
Right.
But you're never going to get anything more than the occasional extra base hit and a single through the middle of the infield. But like we talked about last week, his only real value is with the glove, and the glove puts him in the top, what, 5 to 7 second basemen?
Yeah, I would even go as far as maybe top 3.
So WAR is such a tricky stat because I know it takes almost everything into account, but is he so bad offensively that he's not at all valuable in the field?
Right. Well, I mean, if you look at – I mean, last year's numbers would tell you that was correct because the WAR number of -5 – was including the fielding WAR. And so when you factor that in, you do get it, you know, you do get an overall negative number. When you do look at the fielding alone, you definitely, there's value there. There's definite value, especially for a team that was just so-so at fielding last year. I wouldn't say that they were poor, but they weren't exactly lighting it up either. So I think there's value there, but at the same time, when you look at last year and just the offensive production was so poor, you can't really – you're not in a position where you have the luxury of having a guy just be a poor offensive player and average to above-average fielder. You really need average hitting and above-average fielding.
Now, would you rather have good hitting – that's, I don't even know how to phrase that correctly – good hitting and okay fielding at shortstop or second base if you had to choose the two? Between the two,
I think I'd rather have good hitting, average fielding at second base because of the fact that the degree of difficulty at second base is less. You've got more room for error if you do bobble a ball or you know you take a bad route. You've got shorter throw to first base, so I think you've got room for error there. Whereas shortstop, you've got to be so perfect as a result. So I think I would tend to gravitate towards average fielding or to even below average fielding, but better hitting at second base. I could deal with a weak hitting shortstop as long as he can pick it, turn the double play, do things like that. I tend to gravitate that way.
All right. That's fair.
What about yourself?
I don't even disagree with you. I was just curious to know your opinion.
Yeah, no, ideally I think I tend to gravitate towards above average hitting at the corner infield spots. I think if you can get that, I can deal with average fielding at third. I want to have a better glove at first. But you know, it's so relative. It just depends on the player that you get. I think it's so hard to generalize it. Looking at the projections on Fangraphs for Darwin Barney, just in case you were wondering, they project him to have a better year than last year. This year, he's projected to hit 248 if you look at the Steamer projections. There's only two of them other than the fans projection, and I don't really put a whole lot of stock into that one. But Steamer projections project him to go 248, 300, 344. That's high. I don't know. But that projects to a 1.1 WAR. I think that's probably about where we can expect.
Yep.
I don't think we'll get up to two, but I think one is probably fair. And
what was this 2 years ago? Was it up to four, did you say?
Yes, it was. If you look at, well, remember, there's two different WARs. There's Fangraphs, and then there's there's Baseball Reference, and so yep. you got to take that with a grain of salt. But Baseball Reference, he posted a 4 point. No, boy, now I lost it here. 4.8.
Oh, okay, I see it now. Yep.
So I don't know how that happened, but he did. So
he's he's definitely in there, and he was a Gold Glover in 2012.
Unless you ask Brandon Phillips, and then you might get another answer.
Exactly. The only thing to take into account regarding his fielding is that his first two seasons, so his rookie season and his like trial season at the end of 2010, account for 14 of his 21 career errors.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I hate to be as hard on Barney as I can. I want to like him. I really do. I want him to be the answer at second base, so that way it gives us even more guys to have a surplus of, but I'm just not seeing it. I think I forget which one of us mentioned it last week, but I think whoever said it perfectly, that I think we're beginning to get ready to see a whole new infield in the next couple of years, with the exception of Rizzo. I think we'll probably see a brand new third baseman sometime in the next couple of months, you know, possibly even a brand new shortstop, a brand new second baseman. So I think it's going to be an interesting time in the infield, and I think Barney knows that and knows that he's got to produce. Otherwise, he may be finding the bench or finding a new home. Moving on, we've got an interesting note. I don't know if you saw this come across the wire a couple of days ago, but the Cubs have actually scheduled a doubleheader on June 28th against Washington. Now, doubleheaders get scheduled all the time as a result of a rainout or, just an overall issue with the schedule for some unforeseen reason, but it's rare that you will see a pre-scheduled doubleheader, and this one came as a result of a request from Alderman Tom Tunney that we would basically be able to balance the game against Washington and the Pride Parade in June, and so I think the Cubs were kind enough to probably try to earn some grace for the neighborhood. And do this and just say, hey, we're not going to be sticklers on this. And I'll be honest with you, I like it. I really wish we'd see more doubleheaders. If it were up to me,
absolutely.
I would like to see, and I know it sounds crazy, but I would love to see a day off every week in the season, have doubleheaders on Saturday, and then have the players have Sunday off, or have doubleheaders on Sunday and have Monday off for travel. And then just basically, you know, Sunday is a doubleheader every week. You know it. You can plan around it. You can do it. If you have to expand the roster by one player or kind of use that flex player position, I don't know what you need to do, but I think it's fun. It's fun to go to a doubleheader if you've never been. Now it's all about revenue, so it's a matter of they clear the stadium after that first one. But doubleheaders are cool. I like them.
I'd even like it on a Friday. I know it's not realistic because of people working, but – you get your noon start time for the first game. You get all the people that want to skip work for the day, or they bring out their clients, and then a night game at 7:30, and you get a bring in the families.
I think that's a good idea, and I think it is feasible because it gives you the opportunity to clear the stadium. You're exactly right. People that want to cut out of work early or leave, maybe do, like you said, a 1 o'clock start or even a 12 o'clock start. And just go there, clean the stadium, clear it out, and then have a night, primetime night game. I just think it's fun. It would give the players, I know it sounds like it's a lot of work, but it gives the players an extra day off, more day offs in the season, and allows them to have that rest. I like it personally, and it gives the opportunity to see some of the bench guys on a more consistent basis. I'm a big fan, but I know other people are not. If it were me, that would be one of the changes I would make.
I like doubleheaders.
Ex-Cub Watch Week. I don't know if you saw this on Twitter, but it seemed like every day there was an ex-Cub that did some sort of a transaction with a team. So we're just going to run through them real quick. Probably no need for really any major discussion on any of these guys, but some interesting names that caught my eye as I watched Twitter and watched the transactions page on MLB.com. Kyle Farnsworth signed a deal with the New York Mets, and I believe that was a minor league deal with an invite to spring training. Sam Fuld, also a minor league deal with Oakland. Coy Hill, a minor league deal with Washington. How he keeps getting a job, I don't know.
He's a good clubhouse guy. Leave him alone.
Apparently. Brian LeHaire, one of the favorites for the fans on the blog, is a new member of the Cleveland Indians. Jerome Williams, not a lot of people remember that he pitched for the Cubs, but Jerome Williams signed a deal with the Houston Astros. The Marlins decided to buck the ex-Cub factor concept and sign not only Carlos Marmol, but also Jeff Baker. And so I ask you, Josh, which one of these guys would you most like to have back right now and why?
I think the...
I know there's a bunch of talent there for you to choose from. It's hard.
Well, the two I would probably gravitate to the most would be Lehair and Marmol. Lehair only because he's not that old, and it's kind of crazy that he's only 2 years removed from appearing in an All-Star game, although barely. And Marmol, I mean, I was one of the biggest detractors of Marmol the last 2 years on the blog. I love his stuff. I don't love his attitude or the way he pitches erratically and blew so many games, but if he can find the right spot, he's not that old.
Mm-mm.
I mean, he still has plenty left in the tank if he can get his arm right.
Yep.
I just don't know if Miami's that place.
No, I don't. I agree with you. I don't think it is. I actually went a different direction. I like Jerome Williams back. I think he would, if nothing else, I think just a minor league deal like he got, I think would be a good investment. I think that he would give just more competition in spring training in the starting rotation. I'm all about that. I think we could use the depth. And like you said, he's not very old either. He's just in the lower half of his 30s there. So I think I would have rather had Jerome Williams back. And so that would be the guys that I would choose. I think the guy that most surprised me that he got a deal, I mentioned earlier, was Coy Hill. I don't know how he keeps getting signed. Sam Fuld didn't surprise me. The legend of Sam Fuld will be in full effect in Oakland, I think, after his interesting time in Tampa Bay. But I don't want Marmol back. Like you said, I like his stuff, but he's not the right guy for this bullpen. I like kind of what the bullpen is shaping up to be this year. I think it's going to be much better than last year, and I don't want him to be a part of it. Sticking with the transactions, we got a couple of transactions that the Cubs made, all minor league transactions, and most of these names you're probably never going to heard of. I don't know if you had heard of any of these guys when I sent them to you, but Cubs did release some minor league players that were in the system. Right-handed pitcher Daniel Adrian, right-handed pitcher Carlos Martinez, I don't even know how to pronounce his last name, Eddie Orozco, also a pitcher, Matt Ianzano, again, I don't even know how to pronounce these guys.
Ianzo.
Yeah. Sheldon McDonald, another left-handed pitcher, and then outfielder. This was the only outfielder that made the mix, Taiwan Easterling, and that was the only name on the list that I knew anything about. He was the only one that I had even heard about, and I didn't know if you had knew anything about him.
I know he was out of Florida State, and then he's an outfielder.
Yep.
I can't remember when he was drafted.
He was drafted, I believe, 2 years ago at the most. I think he was drafted in the 2012 draft. I'm looking it up now. But he wasn't a really high pick. And to be honest with you, I couldn't tell you any reason logically why I even knew his name. But for some reason, when his name came through the wire, he caught my eye. If you look at his baseball reference page, he wasn't particularly good. He struggled in high A ball in two seasons. And so, you know, when you struggle, you've got to make room for new guys. But you're right. He was drafted in the 27th round from Florida State, and he was actually in the 2011 draft. So he'd been in the system a couple of years, and he was the only guy on that list that I really knew anything about. And so
I'd actually heard of Sheldon McDonald before, and I don't know why. So I looked him up. He actually played four different levels, rookie, low A, and high A. And he actually has decent stats for a lefty, so I don't know if he's hurt. He actually has a 2.62 ERA in almost 150 innings.
Yeah.
As a reliever. I mean, that's a guy that's probably never going to go above double A, so mm-hmm. That's probably why they released him. But
right.
I mean, it never hurts to have as many arms as you can.
Yeah, I think, like you said, just maybe he's hurt would be the only thing I could think of. Unfortunately, you don't get much news on these things. The contacts that we have over at the minor league facilities, I think they hibernate during the winter because I don't get a single press release from those guys unless it's something awkward or odd, you know, promoting something that they're doing. Other than that, you really just don't get any correspondence from them. So, unfortunately, you don't really know why some of these guys get released. And by the time we get a chance to ask those questions, we've forgotten, and honestly, we don't care. So it is what it is, but we just wanted to mention those guys in case maybe they're family of yours, or and if they are, apologize. My bad.
Take care of that.
Exactly. Well, let's move on to the mailbag. We actually were surprised. We got quite a few mailbag questions. If you guys want to submit a question, we would love to have it. I posted something on Twitter right before we went on the air, and actually I got a question on Twitter. I don't know if we're going to be able to answer it, but we'll try to work it in towards the end of to the mailbag segment and see what we can do. But if you do want to submit a question on mailbag, there's a couple ways you can do it. One is on Twitter. I'm posting constantly throughout the week taking questions on the mailbag. If you've got a question, just tweet it at us, at VFTB or at JC Stats. We'll be glad to answer it, include it in the mailbag, and cite you as being the one that asked the question as well. We'll do the best we can to get all of the ones in every week. As we get a little more popular, that may be tough. So just keep the questions brief, but also interesting for the readers as well. If we can't get it on the show, we'll make every effort to try to get it on the blog if we can. Also, you can email your questions, again, viewfromthebleachers@gmail.com. We'd love to have them. We got a couple of questions that way, and that's where our first one comes in. And this one's from Chad in Kentucky. This is a longer question, so hang with me, but there's a lot here, and so we'll do our best to answer. It is a great question. There's just a lot. It's really questions inside of a question, basically.
This is a question that could probably overlap like six shows.
Yes, and it was funny because we actually got an offer from one of our readers, Caps, to come on and discuss all about the rooftops and all this stuff here, and I politely declined the offer, but I'm anxious to answer this question. I think we'll have some interesting things to say. So let's get right to it. Chad in Kentucky asks, can we go deeper into the proposed Wrigley renovations and the accompanying problems? I know it isn't really an attention grabber. Oh, I think it is, Chad. We're asking
pretty much so.
But I think this controversy goes way beyond surface level issues, and regardless of the outcome, will have a lingering effect on the on-field product. Do the Cubs need better home facilities to be more competitive? Boy, that's a question right there. If you, by the way, real quick, I'm going to note this. If you haven't visited the blog today, I don't know if you're a regular reader, but Seymour Butts, it is what it is with the name. But
Seymour.
He is a regular reader, regular commenter on the site, and he is a regular attender of the Randy Hundley Fantasy Camp, and he has a great guest post on the site today detailing his experience there. They were one of the first people to use the new facilities in Mesa, and I think you'll enjoy reading that with some photos of what they experienced. So keep them going there. Are the Cubs' home facilities hurting their on-field performance? Are Cubs fans afraid to evolve? How important is the extra revenue from the proposed scoreboards? What does a potential lawsuit from the rooftop owners mean to the franchise? Revenue loss, bad PR. Outline the opposing points of view from ownership, the rooftop owners, and the city regarding the renovations. All right, we're going to stop right there for a second. Chad, thanks so much for the question. Try to keep it a little more concise next time, but well, let's try to get through some of these here. I want to talk particularly about, do you think the facilities, Josh, affects the on-field performance, particularly the dispute with the neighborhood in terms of the number of games that they can play at night?
I don't necessarily think it affects the on-field performance as much as it does the amount that they're courting guys to come here from outside the organization. I don't know if the dispute has anything to do with Castro making errors at short. I mean, there's really no correlation between the two other than he's not playing well. But there hasn't been any major free agent signings, and I know that's part of the overall plan that both ownership and the front office has put into place. And so I don't know if making all these additions and making Wrigley more fan-centric, which makes them even more profitable, speeds the focus on trying to win another World – or well, another World Series, I guess. It's been so long. But – in terms of on-field based on the players that we already have, there's no correlation there.
Yeah, I tend to be a detractor from the feeling that a wide amount of night games would be all of a sudden the cure-all for what is ailing the Cubs' lack of World Series prowess. I think it would be different if the games that were being played at Wrigley were being played at 9 o'clock in the morning. You know, because then at that point you've got to get up really early, be at the ballpark, you know, 3-4 hours ahead of time. That I could see that, you know, playing a day game after a night game. But when you're asked to be at the field at, let's just say hypothetically, I don't know what time some of these guys get there, but let's say you get there for a 1:20 start 4 hours before the game. That means you get there at 9:20.
Sounds about right.
If you are anywhere related to the – in the general area of the city, you're probably leaving your house by about 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I don't feel bad for somebody that has to leave their house at 8 o'clock in the morning. Even – and I know that these guys stay there late. They do. But even if they stay there late, you can still come to the park. You can get your hitting in. You can get your shower in. You can get your media time in. And you still have time to just rest, relax, do what you need to do before the game. And then after the game, if it's a day game, you're done. You're home. You're home for a late dinner, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and you're done. You can go to bed early. You know, you don't have to party and go out until 1 o'clock in the morning. You can go to bed early. It's part of being responsible. And so if I know I've got to leave my house in the morning early, I go to bed at a reasonable hour. I don't stay up until all hours of the night. And so I don't feel bad for those people. The other thing I think people forget is the other team that they're playing is going through the same thing, and if anything, they're even less used to it than the Cubs are. So I don't buy that feeling. The other one I wanted to cover on Chad's question was the concept of the rooftop. I don't think we want to talk about the lawsuit per se because I don't know anything about it, but I think I want to touch on the – do you think – he asked towards the end of his question, is there a realistic chance that the Cubs leave Wrigley Field? And that's kind of what I want to end Chad's question on is, do you think there would be a realistic chance that the Cubs could move if this lawsuit thing does happen and doesn't get settled?
No. It's like – I mean, Wrigley is on the same page as Fenway out my way. If the Red Sox ever left Fenway, I know it's a little bit different because Fenway's not in the middle of a neighborhood per se, and they don't really have to deal with all the extra issues of putting up that giant scoreboard they just put up 3 years ago. But why would you move out of the city? Is it cheaper? I mean, I don't see how you're going to get any more revenue from businesses. I don't really see how you're going to get any more money invested than you already do by moving out to the suburbs. And it's a longer commute for people that actually live in the city, that people actually live in Wrigleyville and have spent all that money investing into the community that the Cubs are already in. Why would you move a team and alienate a large part of the fan base and cause a lot of commuter issues?
Well, I don't buy that argument because I actually – and I've never seen the demographics, but I'd like to know them. I'd like to know what percentage of the team or what percentage of the fan base that comes to a game on any given day lives within a, let's say, 5 to 10 mile radius of Wrigley Field. I you know, because for me, I grew up in Chicago. I lived near O'Hare, so that's probably within 5 or 10 miles of the stadium if I'm doing my math correctly. But ultimately, there is a lot of people that I grew up with that lived in Arlington Heights or Mount Prospect or, you know, Naperville, places where they're outskirts, northwestern suburbs, and these guys came, and there was no issues. So I actually am curious, and then obviously the tourist aspect of it, where people were just going to be coming because they were in town. So I wonder if – I would almost venture to say that at least half of the stadium is filled with people that are either from out of town or away, or more than a 5 to 10 mile radius out from the park. And so,
that's probably true.
And well, so at that point, you know, well, at that point, you're not going to alienate those guys because if they already live that far, they're going to come if they move to Rosemont. And then the other half is just going to put those guys in the half that, well, okay, well, now you're outside the 5 to 10 mile radius and maybe we can pull in half of those people. So I don't think it would affect very much. I think the biggest thing would be whether or not people would revolt because, oh, it's Wrigley Field. And I think in the beginning you would see an uproar. But if you told me that Rosemont was going to build a huge, state-of-the-art, primo, best park on the market, Yankee Stadium-type park, right in the heart of Rosemont, and all it means is I have to give up the concept of going to Wrigley Field and seeing Ivy, I'm in. I'm totally in. And if that means that we're going to have the revenue that we need to do what we need to do, I'm in. Because for me, ultimately, I don't care about the scenery. I care about the team on the field.
The two most recent cases in terms of stadium rebuilding are the Yankees, who virtually built right next door, so it really didn't impact much of anything other than improving an older ballpark, and what's upcoming for the Braves. Now, there was a lot of backlash to the Braves shutting down Turner Field and turning it into a rugby stadium, whatever they're doing with that now, and moving it outside of the city because there's a lot of commuter issues with Atlanta. I know Chicago has a lot better system of public transportation than Atlanta does, and can actually get around in the snow. But Turner Field wasn't that old. I mean, was it 22 years old? Was it even that?
And I like that park. I don't know if you've ever been there, but I like that park.
Beautiful park.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't have the same character that Wrigley does. And this isn't actually a completely separate argument. People are like, oh, well, Wrigley's just a park.
Right.
It has entertainment value. I mean, there's an entertainment tax on it. So they have no real attachment other than it's a cool stadium. While other people are like, well, it's an old stadium. We can't tear it down. How could you possibly do that? Not really fall one way or the other, but I understand a little bit more the preserving part of baseball history than I do tearing it down and or making it into a museum and moving it elsewhere.
Well, that was the idea I had, was why couldn't you, and I think this would be really, really cool, why couldn't you completely gut the concourse area, make it into various exhibits highlighting baseball history, and then, and I know this is going to sound anti-purist, but put some sort of a giant bubble around the field to make it kind of an indoor museum aspect where you can take a tour of the actual grass and the bases, preserve that aspect of it, make it inside to where it's heated, and make that park a year-round museum. You know, highlighting Cubs history. It could be a Cubs Hall of Fame. I just think that would be a cool. I would go see that. I would make that a part of visiting Chicago every time I went. Would be to take my kids to the Cubs Museum and say, this is where I used to come and see baseball when I was a kid. You know, you could maybe walk around the different seats and say, hey, you know, this. Let's sit right here. I remember sitting here at this game, and you know, this is the Bartman seat, and just. I think that would be really cool. And then just build a replica in Rosemont. I have no problem with it. I know people are probably going to hate that answer, but
I think taxpayers are cringy right now.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm not one anymore in Chicago, so it doesn't matter to me. moving on to the next question. We got this one from Chris in North Carolina. He's actually not too far from me. And his question is about Junior Lake. He says, I got on board on the Junior Lake show last year. And when he first debuted, but he kind of slowed down at the end of the season. Do you think he's going to be more of a middle-of-the-road player, or do you see him as an Alfonso Soriano in his prime type of player? Thanks, Chris in North Carolina. Josh, why don't you go ahead and share your thoughts on Junior Lake?
Well, that's a pretty lofty.
Yeah, Alfonso Soriano is a pretty lofty goal there.
I know Soriano didn't have the greatest of seasons in Cubby Blue, but we're talking about a guy that finished third Rookie of the Year and third in the AL MVP during his best season back in 2002.
Right.
And his last few seasons have taken his average down quite a notch, but a guy that for five years in a row was at or above batting 300. I don't think that Junior Lake is ever going to be that. He's never hit that well in the minors. Mm-mm. He has an okay on base percentage. I think it's about 320-something, 321, 322.
Yeah, he had on base percentage last year was in the 330s.
And his career batting average in limited major league is okay, 284, but that's even above his minor league, which I think his average is about 270. I mean, I think he's a good fill in for now, and he showed enough to deserve a starting spot for at least all of this season. There's so much talent at the outfield spot, much like shortstop and third base in the minors, that we just don't know how they're going to develop yet. Mm-hmm. But so far, the the developments have been good and what we've been hearing has been good. And that's kind of come out through the whole Baseball America and Baseball Prospectus stuff with ranking the minor league systems. I think he's a fourth outfielder with as like a good off the bench guy.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever going to be more than that, except for the next season or two when he's forced to be a starter because there's no one else to play there.
Yeah, I think if you can get league average production out of him, I would be thrilled. And then if you can get anything more than that, that would just be gravy. Fangraphs, if we go back to their projections, they're projecting him at a WAR of 1.1. So, to put that in perspective, that's right around what they're projecting for a Darwin Barney.
Yep.
Nothing really outstanding, but nothing really poor either. I think I like Junior Lake. I don't think he's a bad player. I don't think he's anything Yasiel Puig like, where we kind of saw him compared to Puig and the mania that was going on last year with Puig. But I think Junior Lake can do something, and I'm curious to see what that is. The other thing that I don't know if you remember, but Junior Lake came up as a shortstop, and so he has some versatility there. He can play all three infield spots with the exception of first base, I think. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see him try to get some at-bats to maybe spell Castro or maybe spell, Barney or somebody there at third, whoever that mystery man is. So I think Junior Lake adds some versatility. He adds some speed off the bench, and I like him. I think he's going to be a vital piece of this puzzle, but I just don't think he's going to be an Alfonso Soriano. Sorry to break your heart there, Chris. Moving on, this is from a fellow blogger from Texas, and his blog, just to give him a quick shout-out, is One Strike Away. That's www.onestrikeaway.com. And he is a Texas Rangers blogger. He asks, what's the general feeling among Cubs fans about Mike Ault and Christian Villanueva? And Josh and I were talking before the show where Christian Villanueva came from. We didn't know if he came in that same deal for Ault or if he came from a different deal. And Josh, you said you had looked up that deal. Tell us a little bit about more where Villanueva came from and what that deal looked like.
He actually came in that deadline deal for Ryan Dempster back in 2012. So that was July 31st, 2012. And he came over with Kyle Hendricks, pitcher that's hopefully going to come up and be a starter, back-end starter for the Cubs in the near future. That's a great deal for a half-season rental, because, as you know, Dempster went on to sign a three-year deal with the Red Sox last offseason and was a starter for a majority of the season before being relegated to middle relief for the playoffs.
Yeah, I think Kyle Hendricks is a guy we could see, too, up in the big leagues this year and get some spot starts. So I think that's a great deal. The Fed regime did a great job getting Villanueva and Hendricks in that deal for Dempster. But Brandon's question then is, what's the general feeling amongst Cub fans? Well, I can't answer for Cub fans. I can just answer for me. And so my feelings on Ault, I want to believe in Ault. I really do. And I think that we'll see better things than we saw last year from him. And Villanueva, I think, is just another guy at third base that could end up being – the answer, where he could be the dark horse that nobody's really looking out for. We all think Chris Bryant. We all think Mike Ault. But it could ultimately be Villanueva. And so I think that between one of those guys, I think that they'll end up being some sort of an answer, whether it's at third base or somewhere else. Whether it's a career in Chicago, I don't know. I tend to be a believer in Ault, so I'm going to stick my stake in Ault and hope that I'm right with him.
I don't think it's being outlandish to say that the general feeling is hopeful.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any other way to put that, because we know what both players have done in the minors at their best, and we know that they grade out to be potential very good starters, but we just don't know when or if that will actually happen. So being hopeful is really the only thing that we can do,
right,
to not drive ourselves insane.
Yeah, I agree. Brandon, thanks so much for the question. Moving on to Randall on Facebook. Remember, you can find us on Facebook as well. I forgot that social media. But if you've got a question for us, feel free to leave it on our Facebook page as well. So Randall asks, in a move out of – and this kind of goes back to Chad's question. In a move out of Wrigley Field, would the Cubs gain any – or as much in ad revenue in the Burbs? I don't think it matters. I think the ad revenue is going to come from signage and things like that. That's going to be the same no matter where you have the park.
Yeah, and they're a brand name.
Right.
I think I mentioned in my rant a few minutes ago that they wouldn't get any more. I don't think there would be any less. I think it's just kind of a even keel type of thing where they kind of, I mean, they're the Cubs. They're going to draw the same national attention from brands
right. And
products, whether they're in the city or not.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're always going to see the Braves. You're always going to see the Yankees. You're always going to see the Dodgers, the Red Sox. Those are national brands. And I don't think it really matters if they're, you know, if their stadium was in the Bronx or if it was in, you know, Queens. Well, maybe in New York it might matter. But ultimately, those are household names. And I think the common fan would know the Yankees or know the Dodgers but may not know the intricate details about the Dodgers. And so I don't think ad revenue is going to matter one way or the other. Our last question comes from Derek on Facebook. Derek is actually a childhood friend of mine. And he writes, with Castro and Baez as shortstop, does one of those guys move to third base when Baez comes up? And then what is the likelihood that Chris Bryan ends up in left field? Mike Ault also clouds the picture at third base if he puts it all together. What is the mess here and how does it get sorted out? I think this is the question that we're all been asking. And I think we've got to just wait and see. I think a lot of it depends, and I don't know if you agree with me, but I think a lot of it depends on what we see from Mike Ault in the first month or two of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also depends how fast Bryan's going to rise through the minors.
Right.
If he really looks comfortable at third base. If he's going to be more just a bat, then you can stick him out in the outfield. If he's going to be a solid third baseman in addition to the bat, then he'll be the answer at third base. An interesting comparison would be, and sorry to bring up Boston again, but this year at the end of the season they had to bring up Xander Bogaerts, and they already had Will Middlebrooks and Stephen Drew on the left side of that infield.
Right.
Well, kind of shuffled all those guys around. All of them played, except Will Middlebrooks. He only played third base, but the other two shuffled around between shortstop and third depending on who was pitching that night for the opposition. So I don't know. There's just a logjam there. There's six guys that you could potentially plug into those two spots. And who knows, if you have two guys that come up to the minors and take that third base spot and that shortstop spot, you can either deal Castro or you can even stick him at second base. I know that's not necessarily a popular opinion, but why not?
Yeah. And I think what people fail to realize too, and I'm really trying to not paint a negative concept here, but are we really sure in what we have in Anthony Rizzo? And so, you know, could it be that Ault or Bryant moves to first base if Anthony Rizzo doesn't tend to pan out? I personally think that Rizzo is the real deal, but you know, I think a lot of it has to do with Ault. I think if you see Ault just light it up at third base, then I think you'll see him be the third baseman. I think you'll see – I made the prediction last show that we're going to see at least 15 starts by Baez at shortstop by September 1st. So I think you shift Castro to second base at that point, and you've got an infield of Ault, Baez, Castro, and Rizzo. And then at that point, you find a spot for Bryant, whether it's in the outfield or, you know, moving somebody. I think – when you have these problems, they tend to sort themselves out. Players will either play themselves out of a job or they'll play themselves into a new home. So it's a good position to have, but I think a lot of it depends on what we see from Mike Ault. We did get one question in the course of doing the show here on Twitter, and actually we got two questions on Twitter there, so I just checked it again. First one I don't know how to answer. Maybe you do, Josh, but Will over on Twitter asks, what are some draft prospects for the Cubs? Will, I'll be honest with you, I have no idea. I don't follow the draft. I couldn't even tell you who would be the number one pick this year. Josh, do you do anything with the Major League Baseball draft?
I do once like April rolls around. But
right, I think we'll have to – Will, you'll probably need to answer this question after we can cheat and look at some of the prognosticators and basically copy their answers. So probably catch us right around May.
The only person I can even think of right now, hey, let's take Jameis Winston.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I want that.
No.
But yeah, so I'm sorry, Will, we don't have any answers for you on that one. Doug, who is one of our regular readers, asks, And this is a good question. First Cub to be traded, and then also a follow-up question, which Cub has the most trade value? So I think first Cub to be traded, oh boy. If you got something, throw it out, because I'm still thinking.
I mean, my guess would be one of the two Arb guys.
Okay. So
I don't know. I mean, Darwin has virtually no value, but depending on what the young guys do in spring training, I shouldn't even say young because it's not like Barney's that old. He's only 24. But the guys below him on the depth chart do. I mean, they could push him out of a spot and get a single A arm out of it. Who knows?
How about Jason Hamill?
I think it depends. They could do exactly what they did last year. I mean, Hamill was a low.
Well, because you remember with Scott, with Scott Feldman, remember they tried to deal him early before the market was kind of established. They made it a point to deal him, I believe it was in May or June, to try to maximize what they could get because he was the only guy on the market at that point. So I think if Hamill shows anything, maybe we could see him be the – I'm going to go with Hamill. That's going to be my pick, because if Hamill's arm doesn't fall off, I think he could be dealt in that June range. And then to answer Doug's question about who has the most trade value, I think – I mean, it just depends on who you want to deal. I mean, obviously a guy like Rizzo or Castro would have some of the most trade value, but a realistic guys that could be traded, probably Samardzija, I think, probably has the most value for a return. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd say Castro or Samardzija. I think Samardzija is the easiest to deal.
Yep.
Well, it depends on if the other team can figure out a contract situation with him, but Castro's got a big contract, and teams willing to take a chance on a young, talented shortstop would probably be willing to take on that contract.
Yeah.
So I don't think he's immovable. Mm-mm. And since Theo, I mean, he didn't draft him. He didn't even bring him up through the minors. So he's not really, I mean, he's tied to him in a sense that they gave him this big contract, but he's not married to the guy, especially if he doesn't get his act together.
Right, right. All right, so that does it for the mailbag. Guys, thanks for the questions. We really appreciate it. Again, you can check us out on Twitter at VFTB to tweet your mailbag questions. Also, viewfromthebleachers@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook or leave them in the blog post as well. We did get some comments on our last episode. We'd love to hear them as well. So that brings us to the last episode portion of our show, and I think this was the most popular portion from episode one from the feedback that I got. And that was the cheesy game that we came up with, like it or strike it. And so, Josh, I shared with the readers last week, about how this game works. And it's basically five rapid-fire questions that I'm going to throw at you guys. And you are not going to be given these questions in advance, so these were not part of your show notes. And I decided to go three Cubs questions, one baseball-related – well, I say baseball-related, but semi-baseball-related question, and one – random question, kind of like last week where we asked about Bruno Mars. So this week's questions here, question number one, like it or strike it, Josh, the Cubs are more likely to win 81 games in 2014 than they are to win 62 games, which would be the equivalent of losing 100. So they're more likely to finish 500 than they are to lose 100 games in 2014. Like it or strike it.
It doesn't seem like it would be a pick-em because those are two opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yep.
I mean, not opposite, but those are two very different for a really young and not very talented team. I don't know if they have a chance to even go at 500 for the season. I think they're more likely to be in the 62 to 67 win range than they are the 79 to 83 win range.
Okay. So you're going to strike it then.
I have to strike. There's, unless they make some crazy deal and somehow someone like Miguel Cabrera is willing to come over here and we trade away the farm, I know I'm being really Madden-like, but there's no way there's no way that they can finish close to 81 wins.
I disagree with you. I kind of hesitated last week when we talked a little bit about this, but I'm going to like it, and I'm almost to the point now where I'm going to predict a 500 season. I haven't quite got there yet. I'm still trying to wrap my hands on how that could happen, but I'm going to like it, I think, because I just don't see them losing 100 games this year. I'm going to like it. I think they're more likely to win 81 than they are to lose 100.
I'd feel more comfortable if the division hadn't gotten so good.
I agree. Yeah.
There's just too many tough games. I mean, you're only quote unquote gimme games, and there's no gimme games for a bad team. No. Are the Brewers?
Yeah, you're right. And even the Brewers aren't really a gimme. Question number two: hiring a manager with a Spanish-speaking ability will be a key to reaching Starlin Castro in 2014. Like it or strike it.
Sorry, repeat that.
Sure. Hiring a manager with Spanish-speaking ability will be a key to reaching Starlin Castro in 2014.
I don't know if that makes a huge difference. I mean, it helps. I think that Renteria will be able to relate to his players a little bit better, especially guys like Castro, who've kind of loafed around for the last two seasons.
Yeah, I think
I'll say based on the fact that I think that is one part of Renteria that's going to make him better than the Swami.
Right, and pardon my baseball history ignorance, but I'm drawing a blank. Renteria played shortstop, did he not?
Oh, I do not know that.
I believe he did. I want to say, and I'll look that up. I believe he played shortstop, and I want to say for the no, he came from the Padres. What, wasn't he a Cardinal?
You got me.
When he played, I remember he went by Rick Renteria. And let's see, he was a Renteria was. This is just good radio right here, Googling on the spot. He was primarily a second baseman, did play a little bit of shortstop, but he was a middle infielder, basically. Middle infielder and just a hair in the third base position as well. And his primary team that he played for?
Marlins.
Boy, he sucked. Now that I'm looking at it. He really wasn't good. Yeah,
he kind of played five seasons.
Yeah, he really only played a grand total of 184 games. His only year that he played even anything decent amount of time was 93 with the Marlins, and even then he put up he probably had a better season than Castro did. But I think the fact that he played the position and that he does speak the language that Castro would, I think that that'll help. I'm going to like it. Question number three, the bunting contest started by Dale Swaim should be brought back for spring training this year. Like it or strike it?
I like it. I love small ball. I love the competition that he brought last year. I know that the managing situation didn't work out, obviously. But I remember when you guys reported on it. I shouldn't say you guys. I'm part of this team. But when someone reported on it last year, I was like, I really like that. I talked to my friend Dave, who's a huge Red Sox fan, but loves
not here
for some reason. And it's fun. It brings a little bit of competition to a roster that's really young and really unproven.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Well, I liked it too. I did like the fact that they also got guys like the the front office guys involved in it and things like that. But I think that has to go away with the fact that Dale Swaim went away. When you have a new regime, you want to kind of cleanse and get new ideas. And so as much as I liked the bunting contest like you did, I'm going to have to strike it and say that needs to go away. And that's not to say that they can't do something similar, but I think the hard and fast formal bunting contest needs to go away. Question number four, and this one was more of a non-Cubs related one. I don't know if you saw this, but recently an autographed Babe Ruth baseball was purchased for $250,000. So like it or strike it, a Babe Ruth baseball is worth purchasing for $250,000.
Babe Ruth baseball is priceless.
I don't know, man. I'm
a lot of money, but I've seen things go for far more than that.
Yeah.
That are sport related.
I'm not a memorabilia guy. Are you a memorabilia guy?
I don't have much. I don't have any autograph from when he was on the Yankees.
Whose autograph?
Ted Lilly.
Okay, I thought you said Ted Williams. That's a big difference there.
Very big difference.
No, I don't have any. I actually recently visited a customer, and he was probably in his late 70s, and he was showing me his man cave. And as part of his man cave, he had a whole bunch of different autographed baseballs. He had an Ernie Banks baseball and a Fergie Jenkins baseball and a lot of Red Sox guys, a lot of Red Sox paraphernalia. And that's cool. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, my uncle gave me a Mickey Mantle autographed baseball. But honestly, I just don't get into memorabilia. I don't have any baseball cards or signed balls or anything like that. I just it doesn't float my boat, so I'm going to strike it. And the last one, and this one was an interesting question, I thought, and I'm going to post video from this on the show notes on the site, but I don't know if you saw this, but Marcus Smart, I believe he was from Oklahoma State.
Yep.
And he was recently involved in an altercation in a game against Texas Tech where he basically was trying to block a shot on somewhat of a fast break and went into the stands as a result. And from what I've read, there was a super fan, if you want to call him, from Texas Tech that it was essentially giving some words to Marcus Smart. And as a result, Marcus Smart pushed the super fan. And as a result, he earned a 3-game suspension. So my question to you is, Marcus Smart's suspension for 3 games was the right course of action by the NCAA?
I think he should have gotten suspended for probably 5. I know that seems kind of arbitrary between 3 and 5. I think 5 sends a little bit more of a message, especially because that's essentially the rest of their season before the conference tournament. So say you're suspended for the next 5 or 6 games until the conference tournament. It maybe doesn't look good for a team that was in the top 10 only a week and a half ago and have since dropped out of the top 25 after losing 5 of the 6 games. Now, some news coming out of this whole thing is that this guy, even though he's a big contributor to the basketball team and travels from Waco, which is Baylor country, in the middle of Texas, mm-hmm. he's actually gotten into it with players before, not to this extent, but this type of behavior has been going on for the last 10 or so years. And a couple of players, one from Texas A&M, I think the other was from Oklahoma, actually, came out and said that this same guy had been antagonizing them since they were freshmen up until they graduated, and they're no longer playing basketball. So I don't know what he said. I think he said in a press release that he said, you're a piece of crap or something.
Yeah.
To that extent. I don't know if a guy reacts like that.
I have a hard time believing that this guy who's – I don't know I guess his name is Jeff Orr. I have a hard time believing that Jeff called Marcus Smart a piece of crap. I'm not buying it, you know, because of the fact that we don't know what was said. He could easily just say whatever he wants and just say, this is what I called him. But you don't see a reaction like that for a guy that says you're a piece of crap. These guys hear these things all the time as they're walking through the tunnel, probably far worse than that, and you don't see them snap like Smart did. And so I have a belief, and maybe I'm just being ignorant, but I have a belief that it was something racial, and I normally don't play the race card. I really don't. But I have a feeling that it was something racially motivated, and I have or something family motivated, something where it would strike that chord amongst the youngster and basically cause him to snap. But I don't know. I think something needs to be done with this fan, you know, because fans certainly, and this brings up a whole other topic for one of the other podcasts, but, you know, what rights do fans have as a paying customer, and what's out of bounds? And maybe we need to talk about that on another show, but I think the 3 games was fair. I don't think Smart did a whole lot in terms of push. You didn't see the guy fall down or anything like that. Probably the biggest reaction was from the lady standing next to the guy. She about lost her mess, man, just pointing at everybody and wanting to make sure everybody saw what had happened. But I think 3 games was fair. I would have even been fine just seeing 1 game. But I think a bigger question is what needs to be done with fans and athletes alike to make this a rare issue as opposed to something that seems to be getting more and more prevalent in sports, because that could lead to some scary stuff going forward. So that'll do it for this episode of View from the Bleachers Radio. Before we leave, just a quick reminder, please subscribe to the show on iTunes so you never miss another episode. We plan on recording every Monday, but just check us out on iTunes. Go to iTunes.com, I believe is how you get there, or just open up iTunes on your computer. Search the store for VFTB, and you can find us right there. Subscribe. Please rate and review the show so that we can have some ratings and reviews and begin to move up the charts, which will in turn help us feel a little bit of the love from you guys. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, at VFTB for me, at JC Stats for Josh, at Powell underscore Scene, S-E-A-N, also known as Sean, for Sean as well. And again, mailbag questions, email them to us. We'd love to answer them. If you've got any questions, just shoot them our way. And until then, we will see you next week.